Welcome to Take the Forest Path podcast. This is the place for unique and creative guided meditations, as well as the exploration of various topics on the journey to our true selves and our true purpose. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's podcast episode. So today we are going to have a very interesting episode, and I'm talking with Hannah Custis, and we are going to be talking about fairy tales. Specifically, I feel like this conversation is going to touch on lots of different fairy tales, also lots of different perspectives and interpretations, and the cultural and societal aspects around these fairy tales as well. But the one that we're going to be focusing on, at least to begin with, is called The Frog King, which a lot of people have heard of as like The Princess and the Frog or The Frog Prince. But what we've noticed is that there are several different versions. So we are going to talk about those different versions and our perspective on them and kind of elaborate on that. So first, I want to introduce Hannah. Thank you so much for being here. So Hannah is a teacher, writer, and independent scholar, and her research interests include the intersections of mythology, archetypal psychology, literature, and popular culture. Her academic background is mostly in English, and she teaches at a community college in Maryland. And she has been facilitating myth-based storytelling and creative writing workshops since 2014 on topics such as seasonal changes, life transitions, grief, tricksters, monsters, heroes, and navigating the inner and outer worlds of the academic writing process, which is so cool. I think that's awesome. And currently, she's working on a podcast series called The Dark Feminist Turn, which I'm also so excited about. And it combines personal narrative with mythic themes and cynical social commentary. So welcome, Hannah, and thank you so much for being here and for talking about this with me.
Thank you for having me and for inviting me.
Yeah, I think this is so great because we both have an interest in fairy tales. And I think that we both have a slightly different like research that we've done in the past or different ways of looking at fairy tales. But I'm so happy to talk to you about this because I know already like preparing for this, you've given me some information that I have never heard of before that I haven't, you know, read. So I'm just really excited to get into this. So before we begin, we decided we're going to do a reading of The Frog King. A while ago, Hannah and I kind of explored this story using some of the exercises in Wonderlit, which I talked about before, but I'll leave a link in the podcast caption as well if anybody's interested.
Very briefly, Wonderlit is basically an amazing online course that has exercises and videos that allow you to delve into story and uncover personal meaning and personal truth from it. And I've used this so many times with fairy tales and stories, and I'm always so surprised at what I come away with. And if you want to check it out, I'll leave the website below in the podcast caption. And the first chapter is actually free, so you can look through it and kind of see more about it. And we actually used an online version of The Frog Prince.
Or it's also called Iron Henry. So this story actually has two names and it was slightly different. So we'll talk about the differences, but right now I'm using a book version, which is the original Brothers Grimm book that was published, the complete first edition, which I really love. It's one of my favorite books that I have. So we'll be reading that version and then we'll kind of discuss it a bit. The Frog King or Iron Henry. Once upon a time, there was a princess who went out into the forest and sat down at the edge of a cool well. She had a golden ball that was her favorite plaything. She threw it up high and caught it in the air and was delighted by all this. One time, the ball flew up very high, and as she stretched out her hand and bent her fingers to catch it again, the ball hit the ground near her and rolled until it fell right into the water. The princess was horrified. And when she went to look for the ball, she found the well was so deep that she couldn't see the bottom. So she began to weep miserably and to lament, "Oh, if only I had my ball again. I'd give anything, my clothes, my jewels, my pearls, and everything else in the world to get my ball back." As she sat there grieving, a frog stuck its head out of the water and said, "Why are you weeping so miserably?" "Oh," she said, "you nasty frog, you can't help me. My golden ball has fallen into the water." Well, I don't want your pearls, your jewels, and your clothes, the frog responded. But if you will accept me as your companion and let me sit next to you and let me eat from your little golden plate and sleep in your little bed and promise to love and cherish me, I'll fetch your ball for you. The princess thought, what nonsense the single-minded frog is blabbering. He's got to remain in his water, but perhaps he can get me my ball. So I'll say yes to him. And she said, yes, fair enough, but first fetch me the golden ball. I promise you everything. The frog dipped his head beneath the water and dived down. It didn't take long before he came back to the surface with the ball in his mouth. He threw it onto the ground, and when the princess caught sight of the ball again, she quickly ran over to it, picked it up, and was so delighted to have the ball in her hands again that she thought of nothing else but to rush back home with it. The frog called after her, wait, princess, take me with you the way you promised. But she didn't pay any attention to him. The next day, the princess sat at the table and heard something coming up the marble steps. Splish, splash, splish, splash. Soon thereafter, it knocked at the door and cried out, princess, youngest daughter, open up. She ran to the door and opened it, and there was the frog, whom she had forgotten. Horrified, she quickly slammed the door shut and sat down back at the table. But the king saw that her heart was thumping and said, why are you afraid? There's a nasty frog outside, she replied. He retrieved my golden ball from the water, and I promised him that he could be my companion. But I never believed at all he could get out of the water. Now he's standing outside in front of the door and wants to come inside. As she said this, there was a knock at the door and the frog cried out, princess, youngest daughter, open up. Don't you remember what you said down by the well's cool water? Princess, youngest daughter, open up. The king said, you must keep your promise no matter what you said. Go and open the door for the frog. She obeyed, and the frog hopped inside and followed her at her heels until they came to her chair. And when she sat down again, he cried out, lift me up to the chair beside you. The princess didn't want to do this, but the king ordered her to do it. When the frog was up at the table, he said, now push your little golden plate nearer to me so we can eat together. The princess had to do this as well. And after he had eaten until he was full, he said, now I'm tired and want to sleep. Bring me upstairs to your little room. Get your little bed ready so that we can lie down in it. The princess became terrified when she heard this, for she was afraid of the cold frog. She didn't dare to touch him. And now he was to lie in her bed next to her. She began to weep and didn't want to comply with his wishes at all. But the king became angry and ordered her to do what she had promised, or she'd be held in disgrace. Nothing helped. She had to do what her father wanted, but she was bitterly angry in her heart. So she picked up the frog with two fingers, carried him upstairs into her room, lay down in her bed, and instead of setting him down next to her, she threw him crash against the wall. Now you'll leave me in peace, you nasty frog. But the frog didn't fall down dead. Instead, when he fell down onto the bed, he became a handsome young prince. Well, now indeed he did become her dear companion, and she cherished him as she had promised. And in their delight, they fell asleep together. The next morning, a splendid coach arrived, drawn by 8 horses with feathers and glistening gold harnesses. The prince's faithful Henry accompanied them. He had been so distressed when he had learned his master had been turned into a frog that he had ordered 3 iron bands to be wrapped around his heart to keep it from bursting with grief. When the prince got into the coach with the princess, his faithful servant took his place at the back so they could return to the prince's realm. And after they had traveled some distance, the prince heard a loud cracking noise behind him. So he turned around and cried out, Henry, the coach is breaking. No, my lord, it's really nothing but the band around my heart, which nearly came apart. When you turned into a frog and your fortune fell, and you were made to live in that dreadful well. 2 more times the prince heard the cracking noise and thought the coach was breaking, but the noise was only the sound of the bands springing from faithful Henry's heart because his master had been released from the spell and was happy. The end. So, Hannah, tell me a bit about when you read this version. Like, what were your first thoughts? What were, you know, what did you think about it?
Well, when I heard that, when I read that version, or one very similar that you shared for our Zoom group, and that one has an extra detail or another detail that really struck with me, I was really interested in the symbolism of the golden ball. And I don't want to quite go into that now. It reminded me of something from another story, and it took me a while to put my finger on it. But what really stuck with me with this reading, and it may be my own bias or personal experiences or research, was the role of the father. And that you might say that he's fulfilling some kind of super ego function, like he's the moral authority. You have to keep your obligations and your responsibilities, or you will be dishonored. Doesn't he say that? Or you'll be disgraced.
Yes. And that also wasn't in the version that we read online. So that was interesting.
So there's definitely about the social standing there, and that in the version that we read online, the moment that the impetus for her throwing the frog against the wall is that he says, you know, if you don't let me sleep in the bed with you, I'll tell your father. So I really felt for this princess, even though she's, you know, she's the youngest, she's spoiled, she's kind of in her narcissistic little bubble, and doesn't think of the consequences of not fulfilling her promises. But I also felt like she doesn't have a lot of choices, and she's being pressured, and that there was so much in this story about giving consent but not really knowing what you're consenting to, and being too young and naive, and then wanting to withdraw your consent but being put under pressure where you can't. So I see that throwing against the wall as kind of an angry moment of triumph. You know, and she couldn't have known the consequences. She didn't know about the spell. There could be a whole story where her dad comes in and is like, look what you did, and now you're disgraced. And like, it, you know, if it weren't a fairy tale, it wouldn't have a happy ending, we can assume. And so I see it as the standing up for herself and also standing up for coercive structures, even if they are well-intentioned about keeping your promises or fulfilling your obligations or keeping your good word. And it also made me think of the coercive structures that existed and likely still exist around marriage, regarding making your parents happy or fulfilling a social obligation, or because you promised but didn't really know what you were getting into. I really, and of course there's the contrast with other versions of this story that we know. And I thought of that expression that often goes around, you know, how many frogs do I have to kiss before I find my prince? So there's a kind of patience that you just have to keep putting up with the negative until it turns into positive, or until you get lucky. And how much different it would be if, you know, it was, well, how many frogs do you have to throw against the wall? How many times do you have to assert yourself and say enough is enough before you find the situation where that's not only respected, but transformative?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And I think it's so interesting that we don't know this version. I heard about it a while ago, but I don't remember exactly when, but I know it was somebody, it was another fairy tale scholar or person who was like, yeah, well, you know, the one of the original Frog Prince stories, she doesn't kiss the prince. And I was astounded by that, because I had only heard of the one where she kisses the frog and he turns into a prince. And we found out that there actually, that's not even the only other one. So we have this one, which is her throwing him against the wall, which causes the transformation. We do have the one, which again, we try to sort of look up the history around when that tale turned into the kissing the frog, which caused the transformation. And I couldn't find anything concrete. So I found in a book called The Uses of Enchantment by Bruno Bettelheim. Okay, yes, The Uses of Enchantment. And he talks about how there maybe was a kissing version one that was actually in the very original draft of the Brothers Grimm that was never published, and then they changed it. But then I've read other sources that say the kissing prince came a couple editions later. So we don't really know. So there's that one. And then there's actually a third one, which is called the Frog Prince, at least in this original Grimm version that was published. And that one, there's also no kissing, but there's no throwing against the wall either. She basically allows, she follows through with everything. She allows him to sleep on her pillow, I think 3 nights maybe in that one. And then he transforms. So we have these three different versions. The frog's the same. The princess is the same. I think the well and the golden ball are also the same.
That's not in the...
Oh, it's not?
No, the water is muddy. And he asks, her older sisters notice it. And I thought that one was very interesting because...
That's the frog prince. Okay, so tell us about that. Yeah.
Well, what stood out to me in that one, and it's in the same volume because you scanned them from the same book,
yes,
is the well is in the courtyard. In the other version, the Frog King with the golden ball, the well is like out in the woods.
Uh-huh.
But in this one, the well is in the king's courtyard, and the waters become muddy. And the oldest princess finds out that a frog's been doing it, and the frog's like, you know, if you'll be my sweetheart, I'll clear the water. She's like, no thanks. And then the middle princess comes, and it's kind of the same thing. And then the youngest princess, and she's like, sure, whatever. And it's that same thought, like, how is he gonna hold me to this?
Yes.
And in that one, I was interesting because the water, well, one, you can, there's probably something to be said for as a symbol of the unconscious, and that's become unclear, or that's become mm-hmm. muddied, because there's some kind of grotesque shadow figure that you're not confronting.
Yeah.
And then I had the other thought too, perhaps more cynical, of the water as a public resource, and who's going to take the hit for the team to give him what he wants. And he asks the two older sisters and kind of works his way down until he finds the one naive enough to say yes.
Say yes. Uh-huh. I think that's what's interesting, because I also, when I read this story, when we went through it together, the king and that dynamic of almost like forcing her to go through with something that she didn't quite know the consequences for did bother me a lot too. And I've read, there are some interpretations that talk about the king as maybe, this is again a Jungian perspective, as being representative of the whole true self with a capital S, which is again, like you were saying, kind of, it sort of understands and knows what it's going to take for us to transform. So even if we don't understand it, like our ego doesn't understand it, it knows what's best for us. That's sort of the concept. But when I read it, you know, what stood out to me was that she doesn't actually really go through with it, right? Like he's sort of telling her, no, you know, you have to stick to this, even though you're a little girl who did not understand the consequences, who maybe shouldn't have been held to this standard at that age. He's telling her, you have to go through it. You have to fulfill your promises. And I think oftentimes when we hear the story, we think, or at least I've heard it kind of thought of as like, you know, fulfill your promises and then you'll be rewarded. But in my mind, when I read this version, that's not what came to me, because she doesn't fulfill her promise. She throws him against the wall. She doesn't allow him to sleep on her pillow all night. She gets angry and she asserts herself and she puts up a boundary, and she sort of acts out of accordance. Like before that act, she has obeyed pretty much everything. And that's the first time that she acts out of accordance. So it's like that assertion is what actually in the end created this happy ending, you know? So it seemed very different to me. And I wasn't quite sure why. Well, I guess the kissing version, she does obey everything. I guess maybe that's why it got popular, because that was a different version where she actually went through with everything and then was rewarded for it, you know?
I was thinking about kind of these animal groom fairy tales overall, and I don't, you know, a lot of my thoughts are kind of borrowed from different scholars and different sources, and I'm trying to kind of work it out. But there, and Bruno Bettelheim, in that Uses of Enchantment, talks about how it's not just coming to terms with what an adult marriage is, but even familiarizing children with sex, that there's something kind of disgusting and you won't want to do it, but you'll find out over time. And that kind of Beauty and the Beast is one of our stories that we hold up. And I think that there's something very appealing about a kind of relationship where if you just love someone enough and you're patient enough, your love mm-hmm. will transform them. But I'm thinking even in the Beauty and the Beast that I grew up with, you know, the 90s Disney animation, Belle sacrifices, and she does it willingly in that version, to take the place of her father as a prisoner, but she still has a personality. You know, she doesn't have to entirely give up. You know, she'll say, no, I'm not coming to dinner, or, you know, there's some kind of banter and back and forth between them. I don't know. It's kind of, do you have to take this dichotomy in which you're completely submissive and do what the people around you want, and even what you agree to, not knowing what it is? And in that story, the Frog Prince, the one with the dirty well water and the multiple sisters, she doesn't really refuse at any moment. She's like, oh, well, I agreed to let you in my bed, so I'll let you in the bed. And in that one, the frog is also a pretty different character. He sleeps at her feet, and he just leaves the next morning. Like, there's nothing about him bothering her or saying he's going to tell her father. Everyone kind of just plays their roles, and like, look, it works. You know, she kind of gets on the third night, she's like, well, this will be the last time, but, you know, lucky for them, it's the third night that does it. So I think that what strikes me about that second one, and maybe about some different, I've looked at a couple different animal groom stories, is to what extent does the other spouse, the human spouse in the relationship, because it's not always same gender or the same gender in every story, at what point do they have to assert themselves? And I think too, so if you even look at it on like a Jungian, an archetypal level, yes, there is some maybe monstrous or disgusting part of ourselves, such as a shadow. And there's also the disgusting parts of sexual relations that, you know, we may or may not be excited by, especially on how old we are and how sheltered we are. And also that you can also have a relationship with another person and a relationship with yourself in which this entirely takes over, in which you're unconscious or your quote unquote shadow rides roughshod over you, and you let someone else in a relationship, whether it's a spouse or a parent or a family member or authority figure, completely dictate what you're going to do. And some of my favorite animal groom stories is which there's some kind of reciprocity over who's making the sacrifices, who's making the demands, and at what point is enough enough, and mm-hmm. and so the characters have to take a stand.
Yes. Okay. That's so interesting that you brought that up. And the animal groom stories are interesting because there are so many of them. You mentioned the Prince Lindworm, which I had also heard before, but that's not a very common one. I think I have it in a collection that's from Scandinavia. So it's a Scandinavian Legends and Folk Tales. So there's that one, which is not very common, but he's a Lindworm. What even is a Lindworm? Like a giant snake?
It looks like a dragon. I didn't
a dragon? Okay.
I thought it was pretty badass. It's like a giant snake meets a dragon.
Yeah. And then the other one that I'm thinking of, which also is not well known, and I don't know what country this one is from, but it's called The Enchanted Snake. And it's in an Andrew Lang collection. So I actually, he takes them from all over the world. So I don't remember where it's from, but that one, again, like you were pointing out, it often starts with, not always, but I think usually most of the ones that I've read is the female. She's the one who's like offered up to this. This one's a snake, right? Enchanted snake. So a snake or the beast or this dragon or whatever it is, or the frog, right? And in this story, basically something happens with the king and the queen, and this snake does them a favor, I think, at the beginning. I haven't read it in a while. And so, and he asks, he basically says, you have to give me your daughter as my bride. And they don't want to. In this story, the king and queen are distraught, but they're like, well, there's nothing else we can do, so we're going to. And she's all, again, it's kind of like Beauty in some of those stories, where in some of the versions where she's just like, I'll do it. She's so self-sacrificing. She's so like, no, it's okay, as long as you're okay. And what happens in this one is that she thinks she's marrying a snake. She goes into the room with him, and then he's able to take off his skin, and he becomes this like prince. And then of course she's like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. But her parents, they're still sort of concerned for her. And they look through the keyhole and they see that he becomes a man, and they're ecstatic at first. But what they end up doing, they're trying to help her, and they run into the room and they take his snake skin and throw it in the fire. Mm. And then something with that act, which they're trying to help her, actually like reverses the curse. And he now, I think he flies away as a pigeon or something. I might be getting that mixed up. But, and so then the rest of the story is her, she's so mad at her parents for doing this. And she goes on this hunt to find him again. And so then she goes through all these trials. So she does end up knowing what she wants in the end, and then asserting herself. So there's a very different change from the beginning, which is her being probably naive, very self-sacrificing, to then she knows what she wants, and she actually has to go through a lot to get it back in a way, which also the Cupid and Psyche myth, this is the same thing.
Yeah.
There's another east of the sun, west of the moon. So that's the same exact thing with her going through trials. So that's interesting. And it makes me think of an interpretation that I heard about Beauty and the Beast, which again, I think in our society, we think of as Beauty and the Beast as, oh, she was, you know, so caring, like, look, like she was just like a beauty inside and out, and that's how you should be. And then things transform. But actually, that's one interpretation I've heard in a couple different sources. It is that both of them were Jungian analysts, but in a couple different sources where they pointed out that actually Beauty is, if you think about it, in a lot of these versions, her father just allows her to be he thinks the beast is going to kill her. And he just allows her to sacrifice herself. He doesn't stand up for her. He doesn't protect her at all, like he maybe should have. And she's just like so willing to sacrifice herself. Like she can't really stand up for herself in the beginning. And they almost pointed out as this isn't really a positive trait. It's sort of a naivety and maybe a personality trait where she doesn't think she's worth it. Like she's not able to stand up and say, hey, you got yourself into this mess. This is not my responsibility. She just willingly takes on this sacrifice that really maybe wasn't hers.
There's something interesting there. As you were talking about Beauty and the Beast and the role that her father plays, or the role, or in Prince Lindworm, the queen can't become pregnant, and a crone gives her advice. You know, I guess they're just around giving advice in the woods. which is, you know, do this special thing and two roses will bloom, and eat one or the other, but don't eat both. And of course she eats both.
Uh-huh.
And I just think that there's this nexus of relationships that are determined, your own personal psyche that's determined by your family and the generations that come before you and to what extent, and this not just being, mm-hmm. you know, in a specific culture, this is a human dilemma,
yeah.
you know, and to what extent are we bargaining to pay off our parents or our family's misdeeds, or we're born into a game of chess that's already underway, and yes. what are we going to play in it? So I can see that there. And I think that that can be true, like sociopolitically, like who, especially, I guess, if you're a noble family or you want to bring certain houses together or certain monarchies in certain countries, like, no, you don't have a choice. You're going to marry this person because we agreed upon it a long time ago. And if you die, I hope you have a sister that will also marry this person. Or if he dies, he has a cousin, like we worked it out. And then there's also just even for, you know, us humble commoners who maybe don't have these large scale political machinations behind our personal lives, just what do you come into the world with? What decisions were already made by your family or your parents? What, in terms of intergenerational trauma, we think about parents or families that have trouble dealing or that can't have no choice but to repress or not deal with mm-hmm. their own emotional or physical trauma, and how that kind of comes out in the next generation in some way. So I think that there are political and cultural elements, and then there are also, I'll use this word universal, although it's a very loaded word, I think there are human elements that come into this. And a fairy tale as like a wisdom story for children, and in some scholars will say that a lot of times fairy tales are meant to be told by women to children, mm-hmm. particularly girls, as a symbolic way of navigating the world as well as their own psyche. So how do you deal with all of this? Do you just let your parents' problems or your family's intergenerational issues or the political structure that you're in completely subsume you? But what we don't see in these tales is just like, I just took a new identity and went to live in the woods and never dealt with anyone again. There's always some kind of navigation about how yes. you're to play, what role you're going to play in this game, and how you can maybe assert some individuality or maybe make your own decisions, even though the stage was already set when you came into it.
Yes. Yeah. And this is something that I'm still grappling with, is that when I first started looking at fairy tales, I was introduced to more of the psychic interpretations of them, and how the perspective that every character in the fairy tale is about an individual's mm-hmm. psyche. So different parts. So all the male characters are representative of more the masculine energies in all of us. Feminine ones are more of those feminine archetypes, those energies that are in all of us, and how each story, there was a happy ending in each story, contrary to like myths, they don't always have a happy ending. So with a fairy tale, yeah, they seldom have one. The fairy tales is always this happy ending, and people often look at that as being extremely unrealistic. But the perspective that I learned was that's there because each one talks about a human condition or dilemma internally that we all go through. And this is a way that through symbols, it speaks the language of our psyche through symbols and characters and archetypes. It's a way that we can come to resolution and we can actually reach wholeness at the end. And that's why there's usually this union between masculine and feminine. Then there's the other perspective, which initially I dismissed because I thought it didn't work with the one that I had learned to love and be interested in. This other perspective looks at the times that these fairy tales were written down. And of course, we don't know when they were created, because at first it was just shared verbally. And then we had Charles Perrault who wrote the who collected some, which I actually didn't know until recently. Charles Perrault wrote a collection of fairy tales before the Grimm's tales.
Yeah.
I, for some reason, I thought it was after, but Yeah, so he was for, he had Cinderella, he had
Red Riding Hood.
Red Riding Hood.
And the original of that one is not really coded about what it's about. It's about predatory sexual relationships.
Yeah, that one. And think about, everybody knows that now, when it's kind of this childish, like, oh, Little Red Riding Hood. But if you read a lot of these original ones, it wasn't really for children. I mean, these had some very serious topics that were pretty blatant written into them. And then we had the Grimm brothers. And then, of course, you know, all over the world, like, we had other people writing them down. And also, they changed over time. If we even know with the Grimm's brothers, I mean, we're talking about the Frog Prince. Those, they had different versions. Those changed. Snow White changed. Snow White, the initial one, it was her mother. It wasn't her stepmother. I mean, there are so many examples that these stories have been tweaked and changed. And I can only assume that, well, why did they? It was because the society around them deemed them either inappropriate, or they had to add certain things because of the cultural context. And now I think there's a reason that even if somebody isn't interested in fairy tales, they know certain ones. They know Cinderella, they know Snow White, they know Beauty and the Beast, probably The Princess and the Frog, Little Red Riding Hood. Like, why are those the ones that have been adapted into film that everybody knows, that you can go to a bookstore and you'll find, you know, children's books of just those? Rapunzel is another huge one. I think that there has to be a reason that is not just that these stories are for an individual. There has to be a social, you know, cultural connection, like you were saying. And I feel like now I've sort of settled upon this perspective that if we're attracted to certain stories, because a lot of us are, like, sometimes I'll read a certain fairy tale and I'll be like, oh my gosh, I just relate to this so much. And I think that that's a clue right there, that there's probably something going on with me that validates why I'm so connected to this. And that could have a personal connection to that. And I think I can work with that. But at the same time, I think that there is a reason why some fairy tales are hyped up, and that can actually affect us. So it can go vice versa. Like, our internal can recognize the fairy tale, but I think the fairy tales that are pushed into society can also turn back and have an impact on us, and can change how we see the world, which we get into this Marina Warner, who you introduced me to, who's a feminist fairy tale scholar. She said something that initially I was, and I want to know what your perspective is on this, is Hannah, because initially when I heard this, I was like, what? No, that goes against anything I've ever heard of. But it made me think. She thinks that fairy tales should change and adapt, that we should actually rework them and retell them. And initially, again, from a union perspective, that's like blasphemous, because they see it as more of a blueprint for the psyche. And when you change them, you're changing, you don't really know what you're changing. But if you're looking at it as like, well, is it affecting us to constantly push certain retellings of fairy tales? Well, then, you know, in a cultural perspective, then you start to think about it differently. What do you think about that, about actually like reworking fairy tales or retelling them
in order to purposefully like change them? And by changing them, I don't mean just people retelling them, like storytellers who naturally tweak it. I mean like fundamentally changing what happens in the story.
I think it's hard to know how to do it well, and that I think, one, it's naive to hold, as some unions do, that it's this sacred, inviolable thing that always was this way, because it's like, no, it changed before it even got to you. It changed so many times, and there's so many different versions. So it's not like a museum exhibit under glass, you know, that no one touched. And it's, you know, especially fairy tales, which are kind of a folk literature from an oral tradition. And myths have a similar thing. but there's, I guess, more written versions and myths were generally assumed to be true to some extent. And some of them are very political about the founding of a city or the founding of an empire. But it's just so interesting. I think it would be like, I don't know, the silliest thing comes to my mind immediately, which is like these time travel movies. Like, I'll just go back in time and change this one thing that'll make everything better. And then there's all these other consequences.
Yeah.
I definitely feel that in attempts to, I guess there were early attempts, what is it, to bolderize? That's what they called it when that particular editor wanted to change references to sex or make them more genteel yeah. for a Victorian audience. And a lot of the Disney versions we know are different from the Grimm ones because of that. And I think there's also ways that people try to course correct by making them more politically correct, quote unquote, maybe making them more in tune with a contemporary ideology. I think that's it's just a difficult line to tread, because even as our concept of gender is evolving and the way that characters are gendered, and we say that the psyche is gendered, and this is a huge conversation. I don't feel equipped at all to get into it, except that it's just a nagging curiosity. Mm-hmm. So I would just think that whatever change you make, there's going to be other changes that you didn't foresee and consequences you couldn't predict. And the more clear your motives seem to you, probably the greater the unknown consequences will be. And what sticks to me about this idea of like this deep unconscious symbolism and whether you can change the details of the story without changing that, I don't really know, because that's a conversation with archetypes that I've been grappling with for several years, ever since I started trying to figure out what this word myth meant and whether it could be universal or culturally specific. And I guess that I wouldn't say that there aren't universal experiences. Like, every culture has had to have a story about death or people dying or marriage or family relationships, but maybe what every culture, every story says about it isn't the same thing. And I would wonder too, when we're talking about this idea of fairy tales, and especially when we've kind of grown up in this, or I grew up in, many people have before me, this realm that's so dominated by the princess image. Mm-hmm. And we think about, you know, what is this telling young women? What is this telling young girls? Be passive and be wait to be rescued. Marry someone, you love them enough, they'll change. And I'm not saying anything that other feminists haven't. But I would wonder too, that if I were trying to change this into something that maybe fit more with my modern ideology, am I trying to make a story that is telling like a young woman how to come up into the world? Or am I going to write a story about what it means to become a mature person, an emotionally mature person with integrity that could be appreciated and have value for anyone of any gender? And would there still be something in the symbols that could speak to different types of people? And what really gets me about that, the Frog King version, the version with the golden ball, is to me that, and I know Marie-Louise von France already kind of went, I'm not going into new territory here, but this idea of the ball is like the symbol of your child narcissistic self, and it's golden, you know, and it's her most treasured thing. And your whole, you know, kind of like your whole world is encapsulated, everything you want, you know, like a toddler or a baby where all your needs are cared for. And it's the thing that matters to you most, more than your promises to other people, more than, you know, what your father says you should do or something like that. And that, you know, even if you change the genders of the characters in this story, I think there's still something there in that. That kind of narcissistic innocence can't be kept. It's going to get lost. Something is going to happen, and you're going to have to enter a world of complex relationships where it's not entirely one-sided. It's not you doing everything you're told, but getting the benefits of being the most loved. You know, she's the most precious of all. Even her plate is made out of gold. Like the sun smiles at her. It's really this idyllic childhood innocence where you go from, you know, just follow all the rules and be, you know, your parents' little sweetheart and nothing bad will happen to you, to, well, you may, there's consequences for your words and your actions and your promises. And it's, and in reality, it's not going to be all way, one way or the other. You're not expected to be completely passive and submissive, but you can't also, you have to realize that you have to keep, you have to follow your end or follow your end to a point mm-hmm. or what are limits. It's a testing ground there that I think it enters into. And there's one more thing before I get off this golden ball here. Because I was like, where does this, what does this remind me of? What I was thinking of this before. And the one story Westerners know is the Odyssey or that they learned in school. Mm-hmm. And Odysseus is on his 10-year journey back home when he's coming to the tail end of it. He's been captive in Calypso's island, and she has to free him, and then he has this whole raft thing that goes wrong, and he washes up on the shore of a foreign kingdom, and he's completely naked, and there is a princess, Nausicaa, who, and there's all the gods arranged all this stuff. Nothing happens by accident in this story, but there's a princess, Nausicaa, who had importuned her father to go wash her clothes by the river, and she's playing ball with her friends. And the ball escapes into this particular fold, particular area of shoreline where Odysseus is sleeping, and her, and kind of their dismay when it disappears, and her going to look for him is what wakes him up. And there's an exchange between them where Athena puts a grace upon him so he's not a completely frightening, naked, middle-aged man just coming out of the bulrushes, where he gets a little bit of grace, and then Athena puts courage into the princess's heart so that he can supplicate her from afar. It's even like, he's even thinking like, should I go up to her and clasp her knees? He's like, no, I better stay over here. And he gives, and part of his supplication to her is like, well, you're the most beautiful creature I've ever seen, whether mortal or goddess. You look like Artemis. And your parents must be so happy to have you, and your future husband will be happy. And there's nothing sweeter than marriage. And there's a whole subtext here because he's trying to go home to his wife. But what struck me is it's the same, the ball being lost, and particularly the ball being lost near water, near something unknown, something mm-hmm. that's an element of life that you haven't had to maybe face or deal with before, is that it's an opening up to a different relational world with different negotiations and trials and errors and the different ways that you navigate it. And the king of this land, the princess's father, actually wants Odysseus to stay, and he wants him to marry his daughter. And he's like, no, I can't. But this is, it's heralding a new, this encounter with the stranger that involves this ball is heralding a new stage of her life. And yeah. I think that has some analogies to the Frog King.
I think you're totally right. And I did not catch that. I don't even remember that part of the Odyssey, actually. But that is such a beautiful, I loved how you just drew that parallel, because it also makes me think about how fairy tales, and Marina Warner also said this in that great talk that you sent me, which maybe I'll put a link to. It's an hour talk to you where she talks about fairy tales. And one of the things she notes, which again, I've heard lots of different people say this, but they say that fairy tales are not, contrary to some of our beliefs, that fairy tales are just this whimsical, unrealistic, you know, airy fairy story. They actually hit on very painful truths of reality. And I do think that going back to like the dangers of, or the problems that can happen through retelling fairy tales and changing them, I think is that sometimes we might change them in a way that does away with some of these painful realities and
and stages, painful stages in our life that everybody really does go through, like from childhood to immaturity to maturity. I think everyone is going to struggle with that, consciously or unconsciously, but it's also a necessary struggle. And like in the Frog King, and you were talking about the golden ball, and made me think about she probably played out there with her golden ball how many times before this happened. It wasn't so there was a difference that day or that time in her life that introduced her into, as you so eloquently said, new ways of being in her life. Like there is a time where we're supposed to be, and we can maybe have live more in this childlike bubble. And that's great. And that's normal. And that's good. There is also a time where we have to start recognizing that our actions do affect others. Other actions do affect ours, and that we do have to stand up and assert ourselves. We do have to take responsibility, but we also get a say in what we want to do, what we don't want to do. Like it becomes more complicated than just, you know, running around the forest with my golden ball. And that's good. It's a, you know, it needs to become more complicated. And I think a lot of fairy tales point towards that. I also think that there are so many fairy tales out there that touch on different subjects that aren't circulating in our society right now. And I do like these that I think maybe should be, or it would benefit us. And so there are a couple collections I have by Ethel Johnston Phelps, who she specifically collects what she calls feminist folk tales. But they're the most interesting tales from all over the world that are still ancient and old, but they touch on different aspects of the feminine. They touch on different issues, and they're very different than Cinderella and Snow White. And I'm not actually saying that Cinderella and Snow White are bad and that we shouldn't be telling them. I think they have a purpose too, but I do think that they're overhyped, and there might be a reason for that. And coming back to some of these other fairy tales and reintroducing them might have a really good impact on especially younger people. I also see kind of this flip nowadays, because a lot of people are talking about some aspects of fairy tales. This is not, you know, this is not an unheard of thing. A lot of people are changing the fairy tales in film, and they're changing the endings and all that. And I think they are seeing that steeping somebody so much in this princess archetype, and then not looking at the rest of the energies or the archetypes or way of being, can be very harmful. But what I'm seeing is also that in trying to get away from that, they kind of flip the script so much that now suddenly it's like, well, if you want to embody some of the princess energies, no, you shouldn't do that. We have to put in like, and honestly, it's a more masculine thing. Like a lot of the movies with powerful female characters have become a lot more masculine. And I think that, I don't know, I question if that's a good transition, because I do think that there are some more feminine characteristics that are powerful in its own way, that you don't have to now flip it and cause a female character to become
more masculine in order to be powerful.
The first thing that comes to mind is that when we use the words masculine and feminine, we're often thinking of things that are binaries or polarities to each other, and that the stronger we make one, the more emphasis we put on one set of traits, that the way you contrast it is by the other set of traits. So that,
yes.
So when you're talking about a woman protagonist being more masculine, I would assume that you're taking a female hero and giving her many of the same words and actions as a man would have had in that role. that, for example, it's just, she's going to kick all the ass. She's just going to kick all the ass and take all the names. And look, we fixed sexism. Congratulations.
Yes.
Pat ourselves on the back. And one, that doesn't make a very compelling character. Yeah. No, I don't want to see a movie with any character where they just, you know, walk up on the scene and everything comes easy to them, and they don't have to struggle. And it's a complicated and nuanced conversation, and I feel that anything I say isn't going to be doing it justice, because I don't really have the research or the life experience to really do it justice. But I would think that one way is to just scratch the whole masculine and feminine conversation and use different words. And it's hard, because what words are you going to use that escape from binaries or escape from polarities or escape from the weight of millennia of connotations behind any given word? And it's another thing. I mean, and then this might seem like a tangential thought or off topic, but coming back to this Jungian idea, or this idea in depth psychology, I don't know if it originates with Jung or not, that in a dream or in a fairy tale or in a myth, all of the characters are a self-contained psyche. So thinking about that, they balance each other, or they show different traits, so that to the extent that one character is extremely passive or extremely good or extremely pure, you're going to have another character that's extremely aggressive or extremely wicked, or like, that's the storytelling. But it's also the reason that it's a fantasy, because our moral reality isn't so clean cut, but you can see it in a story. And when you think of it as like, those are parts of yourself, that there's a part of you that's maybe more innocent, and a part of you that's maybe more worldly, a part of you that gives orders and a part of you that takes orders, a part of you that's like the king and a part of you that's like the frog and a part of you that's like the princess. I think there's value in that, because then you don't become overly identified with one character. You're not the little girl growing up thinking that she's going to be whatever the princess du jour is. And for me, it was Disney's Mulan. It wasn't even a princess. But I think there's so many places that you could go with that. And I don't quite feel culturally equipped, but you know, I've at least, you know, Mulan had to earn her way. You know, she had to go through a training montage. So I don't know. And I don't know if the future of these is things where masculine and feminine doesn't matter as much, or we name things by traits rather than gender. I don't know, because I know if you can have a world without polarities that are meant to show you something about yourself, because I think that's kind of where it goes. And just thinking too about going back to the Odyssey, because I've been rereading it for one of my own projects, is that Odysseus comes back from war and he moves in a world of women. And his patron goddess, who he doesn't realize has his back the entire time, is Athena. And so Marina Warner talks about this too, about some of the Odyssey, but other fairy tales, that women, their heroism often doesn't come from a physical prowess or conquest, like fighting a monster or conquering something. It's through being able to manipulate words, through negotiation, or through kind of some kind of more subtle tactic. And that's the way Odysseus operates with a patron goddess. So even then, we're kind of getting these playing around with it. Like, he couldn't do anything without Athena paving the way. And then, of course, she's considered a mass. So it's all blurry, and it's all mixed up. And I think that's also kind of the danger of trying to be overzealous with your course correction. You overcompensate in a way that knocks a balance off. And maybe the whole thing wasn't giving you a message that you wanted, but tilting it in another direction without even realizing how much nuance you're eliminating, and that you are... Or even just that over-identification with one character or one principle, and ignoring the entire environment and the entire cast of characters that makes the dynamic possible in the first place.
Yes. Oh, you said that so well.
And I know we should probably wrap it up. We've already talked. But there's so much to this. Like you were saying, there's so much to this. We are not experts and we know that, just putting that on the books. But this is something that we're both just so interested in. And we have on our own done a lot of research and read things that other people as scholars have read. And so this is just us like playing with these concepts. And I love that. And I think kind of to wrap it up, what we're getting to is actually that representation, and the more stories that we know from around the world and different stories, I think can benefit everyone, because then we're getting the stories where the princess is in, has, you know, in the deep sleep, confined to the coffin, and the prince comes and wakes her up. So we have those stories. We also have the stories where Tatterhood goes and like by herself without, you know, the prince, and chops off all of these, I can't remember if they were elves or gnomes or whatever, heads, you know, and like gets her sister back. We have Kate Crackernuts, who also goes out and is very clever and very brave and does all of these things without the help of somebody else. You know, we have all of these different stories. We also have the random stories where of tricksters, and those is a whole nother realm of fairy tales that have different types of characters and archetypes. And I think that the more we're exposed to that and the differences and the similarities, then we get to play with them. We get to that's what stories are for, I think, is like, because they're set in this whimsical setting that's not, doesn't seem like reality. We get to play with them. We get to exercise different parts of ourselves. And we get to educate ourselves, I think, as well. So I love kind of wrapping it up to that. And I do think that those thoughts, knowing the social context, is so important. Also being able to recognize the fairy tales and the symbolism might be saying more than we know, because it might be speaking to our unconscious, is also important. And I feel like now, I love talking to you, because I feel like now, to me, that those fit together. I don't see them as two separate things anymore. I think they can fit together, and I think we can work with them. Whereas before, I was kind of thinking, no, those are two opposite thoughts. They don't really fit. One is right, one is wrong. I just don't really see that anymore. So this has been awesome. I thank you so much for being on here, for sharing your opinions and your knowledge and all of that. And I just want to say that I'm so excited for your podcast, because I know it's going to be great. And I'm going to, for everybody listening, I'm going to link, well, I guess you'll let me know. I can share that information when it's out. Perfect. Yeah. So when it's out, because I can edit this caption. So hopefully whoever's listening later on, you'll be able to reach that podcast, and maybe I'll have you on again. Hopefully in the future, and we can
love it.
Talk about this more. So thank you so much.
And thank you for giving me the opportunity to come on.
Of course. Of course. Okay. Until next time.
Hello, listeners. This is Dr. Katarina Guzman. And if you are interested in Jungian life coaching, and or if you have a history of burnout or feel that you're prone to burnout, take a look at my website, www.forestpathmindbody.com, and you can schedule a free discovery call with me, and we can see if we're a good fit.